All right, everybody, welcome to the Other People Show. I'm Brad Listy. It's nice to be with you. Happy 4th of July. Happy Independence Day. I have a special surprise for you. This is a Sunday episode. And my guest is Mark Leidner. He's back on the program for a second time. He first appeared in episode 545 back in 2018. Mark Leidner is a hyphenate. He is multi-talented. He's written a couple of feature films, the sci-fi noir entitled Empathy Incorporated. He wrote a relationship comedy called Jammed. He published a story collection on Tyrant Books back in 2018. It is called Under the Sea. And back in 2011, Mark Leidner published a poetry collection called Beauty Was the Case That They Gave Me. That same year, he put out a book of aphorisms on Sator Press called The Angel in the Dream of Our Hangover. So I'm very pleased to get the chance to talk with Mark Leidner again as he celebrates the publication of this new poetry collection. Once again, that is called Returning the Sword to the Stone. Today's episode is made possible by William Morrow Books, publisher of Count the Ways, the new novel by Joyce Maynard, on sale July 13th. Count the Ways tells a mesmerizing story of a family, covering the full arc from the hopeful early days of a young marriage to parenthood, divorce, the costly aftermath, tracking how that aftermath ripples through the lives of all the characters. Anne Hood calls Count the Ways, quote, rich and complex, brilliant and heartbreaking. And Carolyn Levitt calls it, quote, exactly the book we all need now. Count the Ways deals with new love, broken marriages, family tragedy, parent-child estrangement, and gender transition. What more could you ask for? Count the Ways, the new novel by Joyce Maynard, on sale July 13th from William Morrow Books. So before we begin today, I thought I would have Mark Leidner read a selection from Returning the Sword to the Stone. I like to do this when I have poets on the show. It makes sense. It gives you a little bit of a taste of what the author is all about, what the collection is all about, and I'm going to share with you now some audio of Mark reading a poem entitled Youth is a Fugitive. So here he is. This is Mark Leidner.
Youth is a fugitive that thinks it's a hostage. You know the labyrinth has two exits if you can feel the wind. Hell is an orgy of everyone you know, heaven an orgy of strangers. Just the faint glimmer of the possibility of love instantly gerrymanders your entire past. An exotic analogy to which no one relates, but to which people wish they related, will always outcirculate an actually apt analogy to which people actually relate. A child surprised that a neon sign isn't hot the first time they touch one knows how it feels as an adult to achieve one's goals. The amount of muffin left stuck to the wrapper when you open it is the percent of your childhood that was the way you remember it. Crime is a dream justice has when it sleeps. Boredom is the cruelest aphrodisiac. All you need is love to have a home in every moment, and all you need is poetry to have it be a mansion. Desire rudders a ghost ship. Believing in God is like believing in an endless stream of letters following Z. Loving anything more than yourself is like a misquote that clears you of plagiarism. Cowardice is the fear of suffering, courage the fear of wrongdoing. Nothing is purer than gratitude, and because it's so pure, it's the first thing to blow away when the wind blows. Anything is possible, but everything is too expensive. History is stranger than truth or fiction. The eyes are teeth that see. Grace is a diaper you never have to change. Morning, a more convincing dream. Life is long for a brief time, then brief for a long time. The problem with irony is that it's too soothing. It suggests a pattern to tragedy and therefore mitigates the terror that tragedy is random. Were tragedy patternless, we'd be meaningless. And all the ironies of literature are a dam against this despair.
So my guest today, once again, is Mark Leidner. His new poetry collection, Returning the Sword to the Stone, is available now from Phonograph Editions. It is an entirely pleasurable read. It's smart, it's funny, it's subtle, it's challenging, it sticks with you. I wanted to reread it as soon as I finished the last page. It's that kind of book. So, without any further preamble, this is my conversation with Mark Leidner, and his new collection, one more time, is called Returning the Sword to the Stone.
Most of these poems are fragments, so I'll kind of think of a million fragments, you know, around an idea, or I'll draw up a bunch of single images that by themselves wouldn't be a poem, but the 8 years is how long it takes to arrange them in the right order, cut out the ones that don't fit, or, you know, so it's very much a collage process. And it's not like, oh, this poem's 8 years old and I wrote it and finished it 8 years ago. It's like, no, I kind of had the framework 8 years ago and it took me this long, or, you know, it could be eight, it could be one, it could be two, but usually my poems take a very long time to revise and they're in constant states of revision until someone says, hey, we want to publish a book. Then I go through another intense revision where I could change everything. I could change every line or every order. But over time, certain lines will glue together and say, no, these two need to go next to each other. Okay, these 17 lines are a poem. These 30 lines over here are a different poem. So it kind of comes about very slowly that way. But the generation is kind of just constantly thinking of jokes and stuff. And Twitter is kind of like the fuel, or often I'll think of something, it's like, oh, it's almost as it's good enough for Twitter, or I should post a tweet, or and then I'll say, no, that this one can be in a poem, or, you know, so it's often thought of line by line. There's a couple poems in the book that are more monologues that come out as a monologue, but those are my two types of poems, a sort of collage of lines or a monologue.
And do the monologues come more quickly?
They will. The rough drafts will come very quickly. You know, I might sit down one day and be like, oh my God, what if I had a speaker who said this or began with this premise? And I'll crank out a draft in 20 minutes, you know, just off the top of my head. And that will still take 8 years to revise. So it doesn't. Every time I look at it, I want to change it. Every time I want to change it, I keep changing it, and then I'll change it back. And often 8 years after the first draft, I end up with a final draft that is almost exactly the same as the first draft, but with just maybe one good line somewhere in one slightly better line somewhere in there, or a slightly better ending. But it's been around the world and back 100 times in terms of adding stanzas, kicking out stanzas, getting old stanzas back in there. So it's strange. It's you say it's efficient, and I think the reading experience, I hope it is efficient in that sense that you get a lot from a small amount. You get a lot of meaning or potential meaning that you can kind of take ownership of. But the writing process is extremely inefficient in that I will revise massively only to end up back where I started.
That's interesting. And it's interesting, too, to hear you talk about Twitter, because I think last time you were on the show, we talked about your Twitter and how much I like it, you know, especially stacked up against most Twitter feeds. It's a real art project for you. I think that's maybe the best use of Twitter, is like a poet making poetry on Twitter, or you know, conceiving of the entire thing as a kind of rolling art project. But I want to drill down a little bit more into how these poems of yours are made, because there are two things in my mind that are working at odds with one another. The first is that you take 8 years to do a poem, you know, that you just talked about this lengthy process of revision, kind of circular process of revision. And then at the same time, there is my knowledge of joke writing, like just having a funny thought or a joke occurring in your mind that you then verbalize that works. The same could be said of Twitter, you know, tweeting something that you hope is funny and seeing how it does. In my experience, the funny ones always come fast. And the ones that I labor over or I think too much about inevitably sink. So that's where I'm like a little, like, I'm like, well, wait, how can these things be so funny? Maybe that's where the circular editorial process comes into play, where you wind up right back where you started.
I think that that is somewhat accurate, that it's also true for me that the more I work on even a joke, a stupid, really, you know, terrible or stupid joke on Twitter, I will work a lot on them. And I don't really know why. It's like I'm searching for this like idealized form that I'm trying to find. And the ones that are on there are the ones that are the best. They're like the 1%, and the rest are never seen because they don't work. And I do labor over them stupidly, and they end up not being good. And there are some times when I'll think of one off the top of my head and I'll just tweet it out. But it's not, it's always missing something. I always look back at it again. I'm like, oh, I should have, I wanted to, what happens if I'd have pushed it further or something? So I think that if you're in general writing comedy is and jokes is more improvisational and quicker, and that is a way to do it. And it's but I always go past that. I will over revise. I'll kill a bunch of them by over revising. But if you keep going, I think there is the ability to construct a more appealing joke with an intense amount of revision, although I don't think it's worth it. So it's almost like even when you succeed, you fail. I wish I could be someone who only tweeted off the top of his head and I never thought about it once, you know, past the first draft. And then I also got 1 million followers and 1 million likes and whatever that means, whatever kind of success one envisions for that behavior. But, it doesn't work for me. My off the top of my head jokes are not good. They're usually like petty or like there's like a thread of self-pity in them that I don't like, or there's something about them I don't like, so I will inevitably try to like bury those emotions I don't like to show underneath this like encrusted layer of revision so that I can get to a joke that I don't know, is more mysterious to me.
Okay, so a bunch of things. First of all, when you're on Twitter and you put something up and it doesn't perform well, like, do you take it down then? Like, do you let the audience decide what gets to live on your Twitter feed?
Often, not often will I delete, but I definitely have deleted in the past, and I don't think there's anything wrong with deleting things. I'd say 9 times out of 10, if a joke does terribly, the other day I tweeted one, it got like 1 like after like 8 hours, and I was like, what happened? I really don't understand. I thought this was good. And so I deleted it out of shame or like, I don't know. But I trust, on some level, I do trust my audience. I know when I get people who I know and like and respect and they give me that feedback, I feel good. But every once in a while I'll tweet something that does terribly and I'll leave it up there because I'm like, no, this one's actually good. Or it's not hitting the right audience, but I don't care. It's true to me or something. So it's fun to have those that fail that you still feel proud of. But I'll definitely delete the ones that I'm ashamed of.
Yeah, I used to, I mean, I like when I was on Twitter, I would, if a tweet did not get at least like 5 likes, I would just take it down. That was always my, it was like, I trust the wisdom of the crowd. Like if the audience, you know, if the follower, nobody likes it, then I guess it bombed. I'm talking about jokes, you know, and then there were occasionally some that I really believed in. And like you, I would just be like, no, fuck it. This stays. I'm not going to back down. Like, this is a good
joke. It's like a minor kind of like moral stand you take that makes you feel like a mini hero in your mind.
Yeah.
And, but I feel like I have, I think Twitter is at this, on the one hand, it's the whole world is, you know, some version, some slice of the world is on there. So the audience is full of strangers who don't know you, and they could encounter your tweet and react however they react. But also, it's highly cultivated, your audience. If you've been tweeting for a long time, the people who are following you, they know what to expect. And I feel like personally, I've tested their patience enough times to know when something is stupid but still good, and when it's just stupid and not good. And I trust them, you know, specifically. I don't necessarily trust the strangers who might encounter it, but like my friends who I've had for years on there, if they don't like it, I know something's wrong.
So when it comes to your Twitter, do you have a way of defining the project to yourself? Like, do you have like a real intentionality around it? Are you writing jokes? Are you writing fragments of poems? Has this been something that you have been doing from the jump on that platform? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, did you set out to do a certain thing on Twitter that you can language to yourself? Or is it more like intuitive and like slipshod than that?
I think it is. It does have a definable goal for me. But that goal is changing a lot. So it ends up being as if it's instinctive. But I remember in the early days, I was like, what, you know, in 2008 or whenever it was, or 10 or what, I can't remember when I started. I knew that was something interesting about it, but I didn't know what I was supposed to use it for. And so my goal was like, figure out how to use it. So just start using it in any way until you find your objective. And I think that is one reason why a lot of people don't use social media or whatever. I mean, it's hard to like use it to find out how to use it. But to me, that's also the function of poetry and kind of why I wrote and why I write poetry. It was like, I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't think anybody needs to hear from me or wants to. What is my goal with this? I mean, what is the point of me trying to write a poem and publishing it? And that becomes finding that goal. It's like, well, I'm just going to do it without knowing what my goal is and see if anything dawns on me. See if I can find purpose after the act is in action. So for a long time, that was the goal of Twitter. And then it became more clearly like, well, I think of jokes constantly that don't fit in. They never fit into poetry. They never fit into the fiction or the whatever other things that I write. So what am I supposed to do with them? If I'm already thinking of them, I do like sharing jokes. I like being funny. I like finding ways to, I don't know, share weird jokes like I do with my friends. So it was a way to use the scraps I was already creating that I didn't really have an outlet for. And then going down the road, it also becomes a marketing tool as I try to like avoid marketing and anything related to self-promotion at all costs. But it seems to me like the easiest and least soul-destroying way to create an audience for the books that I would like to write. I'm not interested. I don't like going to book. I don't like, not that anyone's banging on my door to go on a book tour, but even if they were, I don't think I don't enjoy a lot of the things you're supposed to do if you want to make a living as a writer. And so Twitter is like the laziest version of a way to create awareness about my writing. Although it is the least soul-destroying way, I think, of all the ways that I know about, it's still very soul-destroying. So it's not all... I constantly question whether I should do it or whether it's worth it. And I know many successful writers who write awesome books and they never have any social media accounts and they still have an audience. And I think, and they don't seem to be marketing at themselves. I'm often envious of them. And I wonder what it would have been like if I would have said, I'm only going to write my books and let them, let the chips fall where they may, let the audience build what builds, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. I wish I had that confidence sometimes.
Yeah, I think for, like I said earlier, I think if you're using Twitter as an art project or social media as an art project, or maybe to just share things you truly are enthusiastic about, like sharing, I don't know, I love this book or I love this movie, like that kind of usage to me seems healthy. I guess it's all how you relate to it. I had to stop just because I was too hooked and it was driving me crazy. I think a lot of it had to do with the past 4 years and just how toxic things got. But I think I'm better off without it. I was never particularly good at it. And I guess, too, like how soul-destroying it is has a lot to do with how you respond to audience response. You know, like if a tweet is not getting enough likes or if people are don't get your joke or think that it's rude or, you know, there's all sorts of different ways that you can stumble online. You know, do you have an easy ability to sort of just put something up and move on? Or if something fails, does it bother you for a day?
It's a complicated... I have a complicated answer in that. You know, a bad joke that no one likes, I don't really care. I just delete it and I forget it. And I'm like, that's the price of trying to be funny. The other thing, like people actually being mad at you or being upset about something you've written, I feel like I fear it a lot more than it has ever happened. And, so I don't really generally care about that. I think if I felt like my jokes were, if I stumbled in one of the millions of ways you can stumble, I think I would get over it pretty quickly. And so I think that's what allows me to keep going and constantly blasting out stupid shit. But I certainly fear that. And so I think that's part of why I've revised so heavily. It's like, I'm like, Is there anything about this joke that isn't like, could it be better? Could it be even, I mean, this seems really silly, but, you know, I'll take the dumbest joke in the world and say, is there a way to make this joke more, engaging to people, like, or less exclusive to people? So, I don't know how to explain that, but I like holding the worst, lowest form of humor, a silly joke, to like the highest possible standard, or masking my own insecurities with like layers and layers of stupidity so that no one could see it and actually take it seriously. Although I've had one viral tweet and it's very, some people do take it seriously and it's very surprising.
What is it?
It's like it was written during, I don't know, some Trump scandal about, I don't even remember, but it wasn't even about that. It was like, I drink ravioli. It's like the tweet is, every morning I fill up a thermos full of tea, but instead of a tea bag, I put one ravioli in there. And so it's hot water and it cooks the ravioli all day. And so I drink this ravioli tea all day. And then in parentheses in the middle of the tweet, it says, I work at the White House. And then it goes on to say, like, at the end of the day, I get home and I finish the tea and I like the ravioli, the wet ravioli slides into my mouth and I eat it. And to me, that joke is so dumb. Or I like it for what I write. I mean, it's a classic example of my favorite kind of my own writing on Twitter. With just like one tiny connection to the real world, that many people believe that it was real, or like, oh my God, this guy works at the White House. I mean, you wouldn't believe the number of people who have commented things like that. So I don't like it. I don't like viral. I like tweeting dumb jokes, but I don't like attention. So it's really, it's actually more painful to be retweeted a thousand times than to never be retweeted.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
It's like too much dopamine. You just like overdose and something bad happens.
It's this fear of exposure, I think. It's the fear of being misunderstood. And I don't know, just being a paranoid, anxious person. And so if I'm not depressed, I don't care. I'm like, whatever, who cares? Stupid, moving on. But if I am depressed or anxious, oh man, it's such a reason to fear anything. Like somebody's going to read this tweet and think that I actually work for Trump, or like, oh my God, they're going to come at me and like, they're going to knock on my door in the middle of the night. Like my mind will be, really hyperactive and make me wonder why I'm doing anything online.
Well, see, but with the nature of your delivery here in this conversation, it's hard for me to imagine. Like the word hyperactive does not come to mind. You seem really mellow, maybe a little depressive. Is it like, is that something you struggle with?
Yeah, I think certainly I guess there's no such thing as normal, but I perceive my own depression or anxiety as fairly middle of the road, but I don't really know. But I know that my moods go in waves, you know. It's like good weather comes in, bad weather comes in, and then it's a cycle. And when there's bad weather, I'm afraid of everything. And when there's good weather, I'm not really afraid of anything. So I think, you know, last time we did an interview, I remember being kind of nervous. I'd never done an in-person podcast before. Your setup is very professional, and like, it was like, oh man, I'm sweating right here. Even though this is the nicest guy in the world, I've just met him. He's like literally the nicest guy in the world. And I thought during that interview I was a nervous wreck. And then I listened to it. I couldn't even listen to it for at least a month. I finally listened to it and I was like, oh man, you sound actually quite calm. I was very proud of how I sounded, mellow and in control. And so it's, to me, that's a great example of how you feel is not how you come off. And as we're speaking now, I feel calm in the way that I did after I'd listened to our interview before. So maybe I'm remembering that this is a good interview experience.
Well, I hope so. And I think, you know, a couple of things. Like, first of all, I love how you describe your moods like the weather. And also like this notion, which I think is a lot more common than people often talk about, is this lack of certainty about whether or not one's moods are normal. I think about this all the time because I will wake up some days and it'll just be on me, you know, worries, self-criticism, self-loathing, fear about the future, worry for my family, whatever it is, you know, all the stuff that comes at a person in their brain when they're in one of these blue moods. Other days I'll wake up like feeling unencumbered. I'm never like, I can't get out of bed. I'm never that person. You know, that's always kind of the litmus for me. Like, if I can get out of bed, I'm fine. I think when you're really immobilized, like, that's when maybe things have taken a turn. But I think by paying attention to it and kind of watching the weather come in and go out, and you go through it enough times, you sort of learn to have a healthy mistrust, or at least like a certainty that it's impermanent. You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, it's here. Here we go. You kind of watch it and hopefully get a little bit curious about it. And when you're in that mode, I think it starts to diminish. But I do sometimes wonder, like, is everybody going through this? Or do I need to see someone? like how frequent? Like, are the intervals too close? Or is this just human? Is this just the human condition?
It's a great question. I believe, like, kind of loosely, that everyone is going through it, and you should see someone.
Probably both, right?
but I don't know. I mean, I'm a big fan of seeing therapists if you can, and even if you're totally fine, and if you don't have that outlet of a connection to someone who is both not your close personal friend and family member, so there's like a distance there, and also is like has a kind of pedagogical or spiritual or you know, non-you perspective, that's kind of a not just their personal opinion, but some kind of professional or bigger picture. Anyway, I don't need to tell you that therapy is good, but it's a good question. And a lot of people don't, maybe I would imagine a lot of people suffer unnecessarily because they think it's not as normal, or they certainly before I ever sought help, I suffered a lot and I didn't know that, or maybe I believed it was normal, and so I was like, well, I'm just gonna ride this roller coaster because this is what you're supposed to do as a human being. You get sad, you get happy. And I think a lot of people can be fine without, you know, if you can accept it and say this is how it is, then that actually helps a lot. But yeah, I don't know if there's a normal, but I do know this, is that fear and anxiety is always going to be happening, or it's always has the potential to roll in like a thunderstorm. And but when the storm actually is there, and you, like getting struck by lightning, it's not as painful as worrying about it. So bad things happen, and I think people are pretty resilient when bad things actually occur. They quickly figure out how to adapt and protect themselves and protect other people. But it's the fearing of the pain that is the worst. That's hard to avoid.
Yeah, what is the Mark Twain quote? It's like, I've been through a lot of awful things in my life, 98% of which never happened. You know what I'm saying? It's like that kind of thing. Like, we're so much of the darkness is imagined. You know, we burn up a lot of energy on that.
It's true. That's why, you know, exercise is good, and joining clubs and communities is good, because anything that takes you out of your head, obviously, I think it physically reduces, you know, the amount of energy in your brain. It's like saps it with physical activity or social activity. But I don't know.
It's funny to hear you say that, because now I'm thinking about that poem. I think it's called Volunteering. That's what it's called. Yeah. It's a really funny poem about the psychodynamics of being in a group and feeling social pressure to volunteer. And I think especially in the context of being a parent, there are so many of these instances in school communities where it's like, okay, parents, we need a couple of volunteers, and everyone's sort of looking at each other. And then you go into that mode where it's like, should I do this? Are people expecting me to do this? Am I a bad person for not wanting to do this? And, you know, I'll let our listeners read the poem to get the full experience, but it captured something that I hadn't seen captured quite so well before, that I think is common to so many of us. And I think there's an irony. You talk about how joining things is good for you. I'm often like, I need to be more of a joiner. I need to get more social. I've lamented this on this show many times. And yet you go into one of those situations and it's like, all right, we need some volunteers. Who wants to lead the discussion tonight or whatever it is, you know? And it's like, oh God, not me. I just want to go home.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable, but it's like, I greatly prefer that social. I think I greatly prefer that social awkwardness to the kind of prison of your own head, trapped in your room, like bouncing off the walls. That's my worst. I hate that. And I like, so when it gets that bad, it's, I do find it very, freeing to get outside and, go to, like a concert I don't even want to go to, you know, like there's some band playing at a farmer's market. I'm going to go get some strawberries and beans and I'm going to literally sit there and listen to this band and hang out with someone I kind of like, you know, or kind of know. It's like taking a walk. I never want to take a walk. I'm never like, oh man, I got to go take a walk right now. But and so it's like pulling teeth to get me to take a walk. But once I do, I never regret it on the other end. I never come home from the walk and I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have taken a walk. I'm so happy that I did. And social interaction is often the same for me. I hate it when I'm doing it or I dislike it intensely and I can't, all my little judgments come out and I like look at all these people and start judging everybody and I feel like a jerk, even though I'm being nice to them. And I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Should I be a leader? Should I be a follower? Should I be a, if I volunteer, am I going to be stepping on some other guy's toes who wants to be Mr. Big Shot? Like that's also constant. And if I do volunteer and I say, yes, I'll do this. Well, I'm going to want to do it my way and people don't want to do it my way. And well, now we've got a conflict that gives me more anxiety. So all that stuff, I think, though, is preferable to fearing phantoms in my own, you know, office or bedroom and, like, worrying about asteroids and volcanoes and wars that I cannot control. So
I think what you should do in these group settings is bust out your collection and just be like, guys, I'm a poet.
Yeah.
Got a couple of poems I'd like to share. You know, in a strange way, I think that might actually work well. I guess it depends
if
on
only.
The audience.
I wish I was that unselfconscious. I wish everyone was, you know, like, who really are you? What do you really love? Like, let's share it. But, you know, those people are annoying. Sometimes those people are annoying. So you don't want to be annoying. If you ran that statistical regression 1,000 times, only one time would the poet be good or interesting. Would be so many bad ones, and so
yeah, I find in my experience that being a literary person, the less you talk about it, I guess, unless you're in like a context like this or you're at a reading or some kind of like explicitly literary event. I'm talking more in just like day-to-day social interaction. The less you talk about it, the better. It never tends to go well. And have you ever had the experience where people are like, so what are you up to? And you're like, oh, I wrote a poet, you know, I write these poems and I, you know, they kind of start on Twitter and you're trying to kind of explain yourself. And then you see them tuning out and it's like, why did you even ask me? Like, you know, like it's,
yeah.
Nobody actually wants to hear about your writing. They might want to read it on their own time, but I think like a little bit goes a long way in day to day. And it's always better, I think, to err on the side of brevity.
It's very true. I think early on I made a lot of mistakes of that. Like I'd go to a reading and read for way too long, or I'd, you know, someone would ask me about writing and I'd talk forever and they weren't interested, or they weren't interested in the nitty gritty. And my nitty gritty was very boring. It wasn't even an interesting perspective on writing. It was just a sort of narcissism. So those are all bad memories, but they teach you good lessons, I think, about how to, I think really it's like understand the person you're talking to. What do they actually care about? And what do you care about that is a overlap? And like in this conversation, we can talk about Twitter till we're blue in the face. But if I meet like a friend of my wife's family and they're like, oh, you're a poet, what do you write? The answer is much different. But it's still an honest answer. It's just I'm trying to give you what you want and not what you absolutely don't want.
Which I think is a kind of social grace. And I think it's a real skill to be cultivated, which is to know your audience and to speak to that particular audience. I think sometimes people miss that. I think it's a good teacher for sure in any, you know, in any discipline is always doing that. You know, you're not going to teach, or you're not going to talk at a super high level to a bunch of neophyte, like beginner students and vice versa, you know? And I think sometimes people can kind of lose that, you know, they can kind of, fall in love with the sound of their own voice or something, and they can forget to tend to the needs of whoever they're talking with.
I think the teacher it's a good example, or it's a good analogy. I wish everybody, if I could, I don't think I would do this, but it might be a good idea if everyone had to teach, because I have been a teacher for a long time, and I was a horrible teacher at first because I didn't really cater to my audience and meet them where they were. And they didn't get into it, and they didn't learn as much. But once I kind of was like, well, where are they? Where's their starting point? And where can I take them? What's the most amount of, you know, distance I can take them down this discipline, from where they are now? And man, it really helps you. And you have so many awful students and so many brilliant students and so many different kinds of students, that it forces you to like be audience focused.
Well, I mean, I feel like it would make you a better writer, because it helps you work that muscle. You know, I think being this is something that's been on my brain a lot lately too, is this notion that like really, really gifted writers, one of the main gifts they have is either an instinctive or intuitive or cultivated understanding of the reader experience. You know, I guess maybe a more general reader experience. It's different from person to person, obviously, but like a finely cultivated sense of how an audience is going to respond and what an audience wants, you know, from a story or from a poem. And I think when you talk about people who are gifted, I think part of like a big part of the gift is that it's like one thing to be able to string pretty language together, but it's another thing entirely to have it really connect. And like the really good ones connect a lot.
I think that's generally true. I would also though allow for, I think it's a spectrum. You can be too focused on the audience and be pandering, or, you know, you only give them what they want without any challenge or without introducing anything that they might not know that they want that's new. So I think I'm very much an audience, you know, I think about the audience a lot, even unconsciously, and I want to please them, but I also want to challenge them, because I think that's what I want from a reading experience. I want to read a novel or a book of poems that feels good, but also feels weird, or it gives me a lot to think about or feel. So I certainly think you could take it too far. And I also think there are writers who don't care about the audience at all. To me, they're the one in a thousand, you know, who are also brilliant or genius, that kind of they gamble everything on their vision regardless of audience. And sometimes that gamble pays off, although I think it's very rare.
Like James Joyce or something. I'm trying to think of who it would be, but you know, Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake or something like that.
Exactly. You know, the canon of like, you know, geniuses of literature is full of those, but it's also full of people who deeply understood their audience and tried to meet them where they were while adding new things that the audience might not have expected. So both writers can exist. It's to me easier to figure out how to understand the audience than it is to be a visionary and never consider, or to try to minimize your consideration of audience and still gain an audience. That to me is like, it's like rolling the dice, and if you get a 20, you win. Or is that rolling the dice? If you get 1,000, 1 out of 1,000, you can build an audience like that. But for most poets who don't consider audience, or writers who don't consider audience at all, it's going to be a giant struggle. And I've met writers, many writers, who don't care about success or even having an audience. They just want to write their difficult texts or challenging texts without regard to the audience. And as long as they're happy with those, get with that gamble, I think they should be encouraged. And I think, you know, I will read an experimental novel and really get a lot out of it, knowing that almost no one I know else will, because I like the being forced to think about the form of the novel or the form of the poem. And I really enjoy those things because I'm like a, you know, I'm in the nitty gritty of craft and language and all that. But I know that many people will have no patience for that. So the most frustrating, though, is you meet a writer who is unwilling to compromise about meeting their audience where they are, and they also feel kind of wounded or embittered by their lack of attention. And those are really tough, because I don't know what to tell people, you know, that, not that it's my job to help them, but I've had many friends who are like, I mean, I've had to grapple with this. Everyone, I think, has to grapple with, like, how weird am I going to be? How me am I going to be? How idiosyncratically me am I going to be? And what amount of attention do I need to still feel validated? We all make that choice somewhere along the spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's calibrated, right? You know, and I think a lot of it's, you know, intuitive. Like balancing the sense of wanting to challenge a reader, say, or be experimental or be idiosyncratically yourself, against audience expectation, wanting to crowd please, you know, it seems like the good ones are especially the ones that resonate, but also, make motions toward high art or whatever, tend to find a nice equilibrium there. And I think even the person who's sort of defiantly idiosyncratic and doesn't quote unquote care about the audience, that person, especially if they're successful in connecting, maybe not with like a giant audience, but if they write experimental work that has like a cult following or something, I would argue that they, even if they profess to not care about the audience or to not have that top of mind, that the kind of talent that I'm talking about, is tied to their ability to edit themselves. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think it comes down to that part of the process where you're editing yourself, and yeah, maybe you're just trying to please yourself, but even there you're making determinations about how the work comes off, and that's how the work comes off to a reader. So maybe you can trick yourself into thinking you're the only reader that really counts. But at the bottom of it, I think if you're successful in rendering a book that some people enjoy anyway, that you do have at least some sense of their experience, you know, in your brain, buried maybe, but still there.
I really agree with that. I used to have this thought, it's not very original, but it was that I would tell myself, I write to please myself, but I take it as a given that myself is composed of all the people I've ever met, all the things I've ever read, all the other audiences. It's like the self is an imaginary audience composed of all the other voices you've ever been exposed to or that really sunk deep into you. So even when you're like only writing to please yourself, you're still pleasing. It's as if you're pleasing a chorus of all your influences. And that really, I mean, I think, for me, that is a mirror of what I think the world is, or at least what I think my particular audience is, a very kind of, it's like the multitude line, like I have multitudes inside me or whatever that line is. So I think that's true. And certainly poets who are you know, extremely experimental and refuse to compromise their vision for audience are certain. They are made up of an audience. You know, they themselves are, I think their vision is pieced together by different perspectives, and there's probably people out there who enjoy that, you know, like different people. So
I want to ask you a bit more about your process, because the lines in your poems feel like the most brilliant tweets, you know, it's like your best stuff. They feel labored over. And you talked a little bit earlier about volume and how you generate a lot of different fragments and then from those pick the best ones or piece, you know, together fragments that might at first blush seem disparate, but that wind up having interesting connections. Like from a nuts and bolts, like getting words on the page perspective, like what does that look like? Like what does a writing session look like for you? Do you sit down and just like do like a fragment generation exercise? Do you like have flashcards or, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm trying to imagine like how you're making these associations or, you know, picking out what to write about, you know, like where does it come from? Are you online? You know what I'm saying? Like, what does it actually look like?
It's interesting. I feel like I'm always generating fragments regardless. And then Twitter is kind of one output. And then, if I think of a line or an image, I'll throw it in like a document or, write it down. And by this time in my life, I have, you know, an ocean of old poems, old fragments. I have like an infinite sea of a million lines. So
is it all in one document, may I ask?
No, it's in lots of different documents. Like, there's like a poetry folder. So there's in the poetry folder, there's hundreds of old poems or bad poems or unfinished poems with titles. And those poems may have, you know, 20 lines in them, or they may be a monologue, or they may have fragments, or they have maybe multiple drafts in them. And then there's also a sort of fragment document where I don't know what poem this goes into. It's just a fragment that I've just thought of independently, and that goes into another kind of like it's pinned at the top. So I've got a bunch of ongoing fragment piles, and then I've got old poems, but they can be mined for fragments to go in other poems or vice versa. And with specifically writing poetry, I write a lot of other things that take up much more time. But so when I write poetry, it's usually I'm taking a break from something I've been working on all morning, like more narrative, like a novel or a story or a screenplay or my freelancing. And so I'll take a break and I'll be like, oh man, I really want to, oh, somebody emailed me asking for a poem. Do I have any good poems? You know, someone, I think Joseph Grantham asked me for one about 5 years ago, and I'm still trying to find a poem that I think would go good on Nervous Breakdown. It's like there'll be some impetus that'll say, hey, write a poem or finish one off. You've got 1,000 old poems. Just pick one, dust it off. It'll be new to whoever reads it. And I'll spend 15 minutes trying to revise it, adding fragments, taking away fragments. It'll now become it'll be at the top of my poem pile. And if I don't feel like great about it, I just abandon it and say, okay, I'll do this tomorrow when I take a break. So although they take many years to write, my poems are written in little bursts, maybe, you know, 5 minutes a day or 20 minutes a week. And I'm like, I'm slowly trying to like piece together something that is interesting and feels unique to me. I'm trying to think if there were other parts of your question.
Well, I think a related question then would be, when do you feel ready to submit? You know, if there's so much labor and you know, careful attention paid to each line and to, you know, to making sure that it's right before it goes out. I'm just wondering about that part of the process. Like, when do you finally go, okay, this thing's good. I'm going to submit it somewhere and see if anybody else likes it.
Well, I'm really bad about submitting because I need the pressure of a deadline, or like if someone says, if Poetry Magazine was like, "Hey, we want to publish some poems of you. You got to have them in by August 30th." I would submit my best poems by August 30th. But without that deadline, they are in an endless state of revision, and so they don't really finish until I look on my, I wake up one morning, I'm like, oh, there's a deadline for a poem submission thing today. So I'm going to spend, maybe I'll spend an hour that morning trying to put together the submission with all these poems that have been slowly coming together. And if I feel good enough about them, I'll hit send that day. And if they like them, then they're done. If they didn't like them, then they're still in progress. And I don't, I think because of Twitter, I know many, because of Twitter and because of like just my career or places I've lived and poets I've met, I know lots of indie press publishers and stuff like that. So periodically, somehow randomly, I'll have someone who wants to publish a book of mine. And so that will be a big deadline that will force me to like, okay, what are the poems that are going in the book? Let's revise them. Now that we have a book coming or a potential book, let's now move that above the novels and above the screenplay and like really button down and let's make this long list poem work for real and not just kind of casually hope it works someday. So it's often the book or the actual publisher of the website or something saying, "Hey, were you going to send me those? They're due today." That is the impetus to finish revising them and to send them out. And it's kind of backwards that it's a backwards way that I think most poets for a long time have been. All the poets that I grew up studying, I imagine finish their work. They say, okay, it's done, and then they blast it out to all the magazines that they want. But I'm just not good at that. And yeah, I hold on to it for a long time, change it endlessly. But once there's a deadline, I let it go. And if they like it, then I magically believe that it's right.
I'm kind of the same way. Like I said, I trust the wisdom of the crowd. You don't want to be too self-critical to the degree where it becomes like toxic or stultifying or something. But like, I think if you put stuff out there and people are responding positively, especially multiple, then it's, I don't know, there's some wisdom in that. And I guess too, it's a question, or at least for you, it seems like you've had the ability to put poems out there, find a positive response, and have enough of them out there that you have publishers approaching you wanting to put collections together. Like you haven't had to go knocking, like they've come to you.
Well, I've definitely knocked a long time, but no one ever answers when I knock. But I've also had, and periodically someone will come to me and say, "Hey, do you have a book? Like, we're going to publish some books next year. If you have one, we'd love to publish yours because we loved your other book." So that's happened to me three times, maybe two poetry books, and no, maybe all my books have come that way. But it doesn't mean that I didn't have an infinite or thousands of rejections. So like, I tried every single contest for, years and years because I wanted to try to publish a book, and never even, very rarely would even, be in the honorable mentions. And that makes sense because I didn't publish the conventional way. I'm not like putting my poems in like the whatever review, regularly. And so, and I think I don't write poems that go well in, even in a lot of magazines because they're too long. They're like, if you, when you read my poems, or especially the longer ones in a book that has been like pristinely designed to create a halo of meaning around these specific poems, then it's a whole different experience than like, oh, the same poem published on a website that you're going to have to scroll and look at a screen and you're distracted and you didn't buy the book. you just saw the link. It's like your whole mindset is different how you come into the poem. So my poems don't really work that well, I think. My best poems, they're just not, I don't know, they don't fit in with a lot of publication places. Even really interesting websites who publish interesting poetry, I don't even often like publishing my poems there because they're too long. It's like, I don't want to read a long poem on the internet because my eyes already hurt from all the other shit I'm reading and staring at. So it's weird. I don't know if it's true that my poems work well in books, but not in other places, but it's a theory that I have that, I think about that all the time, but I'm always trying to write a short poem. You know, it's like, all right, Mark, today's the day you actually write a short poem that can go up on a website because your friend asked you for one, and I just never get there. I write a short poem and I'm like, it's okay, but I didn't really do anything. I don't like it enough or something.
Well, it's funny. I've argued on this show many times that poetry is better suited to the internet than other literary forms because of its brevity, like the contained nature of it. Like you can read a poem and enjoy a poem in a deep way on your phone or on your computer screen more easily than you can, say, like a 10,000 word essay or whatever. But a long poem, I think the longer the poem, the harder it gets. I think the point that you made earlier about how the poem that's when it's like taken out of a book, out of that context, and also detached from the other poems in the collection totally changes the way that it's read. And that's something that I hadn't necessarily thought much about, is the way a poem in isolation reads as compared to the way it reads when it's, you know, embedded into a 100-page book or whatever it is. You know, I think that there's a lot to that, you know, and it certainly feels that way with your work and in this collection. Like each poem definitely feels like it's of a piece with the others. There feels like there's a build. It's a little bit ineffable, but it's there for me. I'm sure that was part of the intention.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's definitely part of it. I like the book as a form, and I get excited when I think, here's a poem that would never be able to exist on its own. It's not good enough. It's not interesting enough. But is there a place it could go in a sequence in a book where what you just felt from the previous poem is now like flooding into the beginning of this poem? And it's going to change how you see this first word, this title, this first line. And that is really interesting to me. You're playing with the forces of context as they flow through a text and changing how the text feels. That's sort of a kind of transformative magic to me that I think is usually only possible in a book. Although, you know, cool stuff you've read online probably does the same thing. And there's this, you know, the random context or the self-cultivated context of a Twitter feed is also has a similar effect. It changes the flow of emotion through the text that you read next to one another. But in a book, you can really get that working and push it so that I think that there's some surprise the reader feels when they read a poem and they're like, I don't know why this is feels good. I don't know why this is interesting because it doesn't look interesting, but I feel something interesting. To me, that's the goal of the book reading experience. And it's the same experience of that I read in other poets. You know, when you read a book of poetry by someone who's a great poet, I don't know about you, but like I'm not like, oh man, I can't wait to read another Ashbery poem in this Ashbery book. I can't wait to read another, you know, I've not read all his books, but whenever I do, the feeling is very, I feel like I'm changing. I feel like I'm experiencing some kind of magical transformation because it's in a book, because these words, their meaning grows and changes and embiggens based on the context around them.
I think that, I mean, you talk about Ashbery. I think there's some, I feel like your work has an accessibility to it. It doesn't have, it's not that it isn't challenging, but I guess where I get most frustrated is with maybe the more like really explicitly experimental work or work that's really high-minded, and you have to have a very sophisticated understanding of poetry and language to even be able to get anything from it tangible. I love work, and this is where I think I respond so well to yours, that kind of works on multiple levels. And I think crucially too, has humor in it. I love that you're telling jokes. so often, you know, literature can be too humorless, you know, and certainly this world kind of feels starving for a laugh. So I don't know. I appreciate the fact that you're doing all these different things, but it certainly never feels cheap. You know, you're not going for the cheap laugh. Like it's a deep laugh. And, you know, earlier we were talking about joke writing, which I like too. Like that's such a thrill to put down some words on a page that make you laugh. You know, it's like, oh, that's great. What a nice use of language. Right. And I think like my experience has just been that when they cut like a joke that flowers quickly in my mind, it tends to find a better response from an audience. And I think there's truth to it, but I think there are also comedians or humor writers or poets or whatever you want to call it, who are working in maybe what I guess you could characterize as a slower mode. And I think, for example, of like Jack Handy, you know, they're
certainly
like, he's writing jokes like capital R, you know what I'm saying? Like, that those are written jokes. They're little like contained paragraphs. Anthony Jeselnik, I don't know if you've ever seen his act, but he does the same. He's writing like they're little block paragraphs, really, you know, like that's the way that they probably look on the page. George Carlin was a very heavily written comic. It came off like a rambling screed, but he was a guy who clearly loved language and would sit down and I have to believe he'd write painstakingly, like every word of the thing, and then memorize it and maybe with some little deviation on stage perform it. And then there are, I think, different comics or funny people who they're riffing, you know, and they have kind of a loose they have like a framework for the joke and they know how to like fill it in, you know what I'm saying? They might come up with certain tropes, but you're more of like a Jack Handy or a Jeselnik.
Well, that's very complimentary. I remember Jack Candy's probably my first favorite writer I ever had. I remember as a little boy, my dad he bought those books. I'd get to stay up late and watch Saturday Night Live, and those are really the only parts of Saturday Night Live I got. I thought the deep thoughts were hilarious, and so I had those books and I'd read them over and over and over on long car rides. And I only recently realized that literally that the voice of that, the like trying to push the stupidity of a narrative so far that it feels inexplicable is really my favorite, you know, way to write jokes, and maybe the only way I actually write anything funny. But so yeah, I'm definitely not an improvisational funny person, although in real life, I think I'm much funnier, you know, improvisationally, but really only around people I really know. I'm not that funny to, you know, sometimes like I have a friend named Mike who's really good at improv, and he would do, you know, comedy in shows, and he had this troupe and all that. I mean, he could be so funny, just meeting total strangers, instantly hilarious. And I'm always just standing there like, I got to think for a long time to be funny. Like, I don't know what's funny to these people. I don't know what's funny. I don't know what to say to them. I don't know them. So, you know, but around my family, I'm very funny. Like, everybody's funny around their family, probably. So it makes sense to me that these jokes feel like wrought and not, not like I don't not just like tossed out in a blaze of manic creativity, but like architected or constructed or something.
Well, but also like beaten to death. You know, that's kind of the point.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like that is illuminating to me because I miss that sometimes. It's like, oh yeah, you know, like what would happen to me, I think, is that I would be working on a joke and it would be frustrating me. You know, I'd be like, oh, I just can't get the twist. You know, I can't get the laugh. Yeah. And then I would abandon it. And I think what you're doing is like you're continuing to just hammer the thing and push it.
Oh, yeah.
Like push it. And that's
I'll keep it in the draft folder in the Twitter draft folder, you know, a long joke, like 75 characters over the limit. And I'm like, one day, like 5 years from now, I'm going to look at this and I'm going to instantly know the right way to tell that joke, but not today.
Well, I'm feeling very proud of myself for the Jack Handy reference, and I had no idea that he was a central figure in your creative youth or whatever, you know. But I can definitely see the similarities, and I share with you admiration for him. Like, I don't think there's enough of it. Almost, there's not that many comics working that way. But they're literary comics. They really are, you know. Like it's like a short form monologue poem almost, you know, that has a zinger at the end.
Yeah, I don't know what it would be like if someone was doing Jack Handy style comedy, like on stage, or I know there's comics who do that sort of thing, but.
Well,
he's the best.
Yeah, no, I was like the reason I bring up Jeselnik is just because it was like a pandemic watch that really made me laugh. I ate a gummy, you know, I got to give you full context. So if I'm overselling it, I was in the mood for it. It was like super dark, but I found myself thinking a lot about why it worked, you know, because after you get a good laugh, you're like, wow, why did that work on me so well? And, you know, the only thing I could say is that A, you've got to be practiced at your delivery. But the second thing is that Jeselnik is like a good looking guy, and like a crucial part of his act is that he embodies on stage, like his onstage persona is that of the like supremely self-confident prick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I'm saying? That's part of the joke, is that he embodies that all the time on the stage as he delivers his lines. And I'm wondering if maybe like taking on a persona, not necessarily that persona, but having like a performative element like that coupled with the good writing is what you need to make it effective on stage. Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
yes, I think it's very true. It's like, it's the context, it's the invisible context. I mean, what he looks like is not invisible, but it's, if you just were to look at his jokes, his context is the delivery, what he looks like, how he delivers, what he's wearing, where he's standing. That is all invisible if you just saw the text. And it's that flow of context through the text that creates that tension that makes people laugh. And Jack Handy is the same thing, is that his words were presented on TV screens with like nature, like a babbling brook in the background and a big cursive deep thoughts typeface. And it's that context of seriousness or like of harmony or of like new agey kind of psychobabble that makes his absurd stories inflected with tension. And I think it's no different in my book or in anything that's, or I think it's similar in my book, in that the book is really nicely designed and quiet and calm and has this kind of halo of meaning, of importance, of poetry around it. And if it weren't for that, I think a lot of the jokes might come off as, it would just be different. And the tension between something very stupid like a velociraptor chasing you through the jungle and the yin yang necklace around the velociraptor's bouncing off his turtleneck, this like the stupidity of that in the context of the kind of mannered seriousness of poetry is why I think it's interesting. And it's why it's so much easier to be funny at a poetry reading than to be funny as a comedian, because comedians are expected to be funny. So how do you, where's the tension? You know, you have to be really, really funny and unexpectedly funny in order to create tension between your comedic context. And a poet has a much easier job of just be really stupid, and the halo of importance around you will often create enough tension for people to laugh.
That's true, huh? And I think too, like something of an inverse to that is the fact that, you know, well, no, I guess it's not really, it's not that related, but I'm thinking about the way in which like a really gifted comedy writer like Jack Handy, you know, he's presented in that televisual context where he's reading his stuff and there's the babbling brook, and it's, I kind of love that old aesthetic of the deep thoughts on Saturday Night Live. You know, it was kind of antiquated. Yeah. I think it was kind of antiquated even in its day. It felt like a throwback even in its day. But you have that context, you know, that I think makes it funnier. But it still is funny when you read it, which I think is important. That's the key, because like you read these jokes just on a blank white piece of paper, you would know that it was funny. And then you add these other elements, and I think it heightens the effect. And I was thinking too, you know, of these, we were talking about these kind of like monologue-y, like paragraph joke writers. Then I think there are like the longer monologue joke writers like Carlin, who just, it feels like this winding thing, you know, that he takes you on. But then there's like a comedian like Stephen Wright or Mitch Hedberg, which are even shorter than the paragraph. They're like the one-liners. But Stephen Wright is another guy who, you know, the whole thing, the voice, the appearance, like the whole package, you know, it's all part of it. And you know, he'd be funny on the page, but it's obviously best to experience it, you know, in all of its effects.
It's true. It's that, you know, all of these comedians are great comic writers, but it's how you put steroids on that in the contextual ways, like a Stephen Wright delivery is like, there's a shitload of tension in what he presents as and what he's saying. And you just can't reconcile it because his 1,000-yard stare is just so intense and his, I don't know. So I think that maybe you could say that like a lot of comedians are actually great writers, but what's hard is to put the right steroids or gasoline or context around it to really make it be like you can't look away, or you feel the shock of the new just by watching them. And I feel like if you go to amateur comedy nights, obviously there's lots of bad jokes there, but there's lots of good jokes too, but not the extra thing of how to manipulate context so that the joke really kicks you, or the presentation really hits you.
It's funny, you know, because, you know, you watch like a documentary on comedians, or you read enough about comedy, you know, that that's how they, like their rough drafts basically happen on stage. Like Chris Rock will go work comedy clubs when he's trying to put an hour together, or Jerry Seinfeld, these guys who are considered great, and they will just bomb. They will bomb, you know, time after time. They'll get up in front of a crowd and like nobody, you know, after the, like, you know, the courtesy laughs at the beginning, like if the jokes don't work, the jokes don't work. And it makes me think about like that part of it exactly. Like trying to, like you might have the joke on paper pretty right, but then you've also got to figure out like, well, oh, I need to pause here. I wasn't pausing long enough. You've got to give the audience enough time to catch up. Like you get sort of calibrated in all those little tiny ways that nobody can see. And then, you know, once you've got all that mastered, then you can go out on tour and kill most nights, you know, like, so when you see the 1 hour special on HBO, it's like at the end of that long process and it looks sort of effortless, but there's probably so much going on, you know, internally and in the room itself and all of it, you know?
Yeah. It's really fun to watch, you know. I feel like when you watch a great comedian, often you'll be laughing But the thing is, if you were to take that joke that you laughed so hard at and look at it alone, again, it would not be that funny. Or like, I don't know, a lot of people, they hate on Seinfeld, but I mean, when I was a kid and we were watching Seinfeld and his little stand-up routines in the, during the show, I often thought they were so funny, but I didn't understand why. I'm like, it's not actually interesting or funny what he's saying. There's no, I don't recognize the joke, but it's the flow, it's the delivery, it's the context, it's the perfect pauses or whatever. It's like he squeezes blood out of a lemon, you know, or a turnip, sorry. And I think that becomes watching someone be funnier than they should be is actually more funny than someone who's like playing with dynamite and has like the most hilarious content. And it's already too funny, or it's obviously funny. So I sometimes think that in poetry, it's similar. Like if you can write a poem that should not be interesting, but it actually is, that to me becomes more interesting than someone who's like juggling 5,000 awesome sounding words and it's like full of jingles and jangles and crazy interestingness. It's almost hard to appreciate. So even though it should objectively be much more interesting.
It's making me think of voice, and it's making me think of like identity and like the personalization of it. Like, think about, just to use Seinfeld since you brought him up, like his voice is so distinct and it's impossible to think of him as a comedic figure without hearing the sound of him, you know? And same with Chris Rock, like that voice, and that Stephen Wright. It's making me think of like the voice as an instrument, and it's making me think of maybe finding a way to tell the joke that's so personal and so embedded into who you are, who he is or who she is, like as a person, temperamentally, emotionally, psycho-spiritually, but also in terms of like how they sound, you know, like the phrasing in his particular voice with his particular timbre and accent and all the rest. Like maybe when you're listening to a joke that's funnier than it should be, it's due to something like that, you know, it's like that weird mixture that's working.
Yeah, I think that has to be, I mean, I think that's true. It also has to be true. I mean, what else would you learn about by going out and bombing night after night after night after night, if not the timbre of your voice, where your eyes go, like, you know, your body is constantly receiving that information of failure or success. And so, I do think that's true. It would be funny to see like an app where you could take like a one comedian's routine and make another comedian's delivery say it. So yeah. You're like watching Chris Rock do George Carlin, and like, would it be funny? Maybe, but I mean, it might be funny for all kinds of different reasons. But once the novelty wore off, and you showed it to a stranger who didn't know who either of these comedians were, would they think it was funny? I don't know.
Makes me also think about the importance of like having a good voice, like kind of like you would use it in a musical context. Feels like a lot of these comedians have really good voices, like Dave Chappelle. That dude's got such a great voice. Like that's part of it. It's part of the reason he's so effective up there. Is that like he's just got that awesome voice. And I wonder if he would not be. I have to believe he would not be nearly as funny without it. And it makes me wonder if there are people who are actually talented joke writers, but who lack whatever voice you might need. You know, they just don't have the great performative voice, and so they can't get up there and do it. You know, like,
it could be that, you know. But I think it's something that they would learn. I think if you decide I'm going to be a comedian, I'm going to write my ass off, I'm going to perform, I'm going to learn, I'm going to get better, your voice would probably, you know, do you know any actors? I've known a couple actors who like do this voice based, like their actor training, their school of how they think of it is vocal. It's like, it all starts in the voice, and it's they find the voice they find their voice through the character or whatever, but it's like they get the voice right, and their body, you know, their mannerisms, their actual, the rest of their acting kind of takes care of it. And I think performing night after night, just show business, it's like in any context, is gonna build your, if you're gonna keep doing it over and over, your voice will probably develop. I mean, I feel like my voice gets better when I'm teaching a lot. You know, if I'm teaching semester after semester and I'm talking constantly, how I talk becomes better. And now with the pandemic, I haven't really been teaching in classes for a long time. So, man, when I start talking to random, just random people in life, my voice doesn't even feel, I feel like, oh my God, what do I sound like? I sound like an idiot. So it's, I think you have a great voice because I would say arguably, maybe you were born with it, but it's probably because you practice, or you just, you know, this is what you do. And like, it's very, it feels authentic, feels rich, you know? So it's, I would say,
I think like,
has it always been exactly this?
No.
Or have you, has your voice gotten better?
Well, I think if I mean, I don't listen to a lot of my old episodes, but I know I can, like, every once in a while I'll push play on one from like 7 years ago and cringe. Are you, like, yeah. I think like lower and softer, I think, is where I'm at. Like, I think if I'm keyed up, I'm talking like louder and high, you know, like, and if you're, I think like this is more how I actually talk. I don't know. But then even that can become affected if you're thinking about it. You just basically don't want to be self-conscious at all. But I used to shout too much. Like, you do learn how to relate to a microphone better the more you do it. And sometimes I'm like, why am I yelling? Like, I'm just like just shouting into a microphone for some reason. But, you know, you live and learn. And I guess like a related question for somebody who's as funny as you are is whether or not you've ever performed. You know, you kind of mentioned earlier that you don't love, I don't think you love performance, but have you ever thought about being a stand-up comedian?
I have done it a little bit a long time ago. I would go to an open mic and try it out, and I bombed most of the time, but I was, I don't know why I was doing it. I think I was bored, and I wanted to try it. And it's like one time I did good, and people were really laughing, and I didn't completely forget my whole set, and it worked, and it felt so good. I just felt like I was flying. And then I realized that if I wanted to keep doing it and do that feeling, it was going to be so hard and it was going to take so long. And I looked around at the other open mic people full of, you know, other people who were doing it for much longer and had real ambitions to, you know, become stand-ups or do comedy semi-professionally or whatever. And it looked so sad, and everything I knew about the life of a comic was so hard and sad and full of like cigarettes and booze. And like, I don't know if you could constantly be under that spotlight and go up there and feel the pain of failure. And then I don't know how I would regulate my emotions and still be a calm or whatever happy person. And also, by that point, I'd spent so much time trying to be a writer of poetry and fiction and all this other things. I was like, we're not starting. It was like, it felt good one time, and we're not starting. We're not going to just change gears based on that. So I don't know. I had this epiphany that it would be too hard to be successful, and probably wouldn't be successful anyway. So, but I'm so glad I did. Oh, I had a friend who I saw one time, and she had mentioned wanting to do stand up at this open mic. And I randomly ran into her one day, and I was like, let's do it together. We had a pact. Like, we'll both do it. We'll workshop our jokes. We'll get up there, and we'll be afraid, but we won't back down. And we did it. And it felt great to kind of conquer that fear. And I think everybody should try it at least once if they can, just to try it and know that like the hardest part is walking onto the stage. I've never felt more nervous than right before I went up, and it was like five people in this stupid bar. There's no stakes for failing. but it just felt like your heart is just pounding out of your chest, and you're just flooded with all kinds of hormones and, I don't know, adrenaline. And to get up there and the light comes on, or it's on you and you can't see the crowd, and you just start talking, and it's an out-of-body experience. And you sit down and you just feel like you're floating. So it's such a weird experience that I highly recommend it to any writer. And I think it's a metaphor for a lot of life and a lot of writing. Anyway, I could talk forever about that.
Yeah, no, period. Making me think of a couple. I had like Sam Talen on the program not too long ago. He's a comedian, and he wrote a great novel about a comedian called Running the Light, which I recommend. If you haven't read it, you'd probably dig it. But I'm also thinking, too, of Leland Chuck, who was on the show, and I think as part of like experiential research. My memory is spotty, but I want to say he went out and is like doing experiential research for a book. He was like basically a working comedian in New York City for a couple of years. Like he would go out to open mics and he'd do the clubs, you know, he was really on that circuit, but the ulterior motive was to write about it, you know, not necessarily to, I think if like great success had come, you know, like, you know, it would have been a bit of a surprise, and I think he would have rode the wave, but it was mostly just to get to know that life. And I agree with you. I think, I mean, God, for anybody to go through that would be a useful exercise. At the very least, it would help you with your fear of public speaking, right? I mean,
it's funny that, because a few years after I did that, there was a public speaking class up, you know, they needed a teacher for it at a college. And I applied for it, and I was like, I don't know anything about public speaking, but I did. My pitch was I did stand up for a couple weeks one summer, and I feel like I learned a lot, and that's what I would teach. Just like stand up, get up there, and face the spotlight and say something you care about, or, you know, say something that you think is interesting, and then sit down. And it was really all I ever taught.
Wait, did you get the job?
Yeah.
That's quite a pitch. I did stand up for 2 weeks one summer. And they're like, you're hired.
Well, you know, their bar's pretty low.
But, yeah, I was going to say.
It was a very weird class. It was like on an Air Force base. And it was like you had to go in. It was an elaborate, complicated schedule. And I was probably the only guy willing to do it. But I did think that I could teach the class because I had learned so much from that experience, and I didn't really have any other formal understanding of public speaking. It was just like the power of overcoming your fear by forcing yourself to get up in front of people and then literally be yourself if you can. Try to be yourself if you can. And, you know, some students liked it, some didn't, but it was like, it was not how other people were expecting, not how they were expecting to be taught public speaking. But
I think that, you know, not everybody can be funny, but if you're going to be giving a speech, you can work in a simple joke. I feel like that's great advice. You know, if you're going to make people suffer through a speech of yours, you can at least throw in a joke or two. And it's a good way to just soften them up, get yourself comfortable. Like nothing makes you more comfortable up in front of people than if they laugh at one of your dumb jokes, you know, like it's a good way to find your footing. So I think there's a lot to learn from, you know, from the stand-up experience that would be applicable. And, you know, I think too, being a writer and somebody who deals in narrative storytelling, you know, if you know how to tell a reasonably good story, that's another way to get in with people, you know, is to stand up and, I don't know, like relate something or tell a funny anecdote and bring people in.
For sure. I mean, that was really the first two speeches that we taught was tell a story about something that happened, like something you did as a kid that taught you something. And I was like, I don't care about introductions, conclusions, like just stand up. Tell a story you've told before, but now you're doing it in front of strangers. And I feel like if you just do that, you learn a lot. You learn, I don't know, all the things you learn when you perform are
essentially intuitive. They're very hard to, like, they're particular to you. They're particular to your content. And it's very hard to say, here are the five things we must all learn as public speakers. But if you can learn the one thing of don't be afraid to be yourself in front of strangers, risk the rejection and the fear of rejection, then the payoff you often get is a sense of belonging or a sense of you've made meaning or whatever. And that's worth it. And how it translates from fear of failure to sense of meaning that you've made or sense of belonging is going to be different for everybody. You know, my aunt tells a story differently than my brother, and they're very different, but they're both authentic to them. And that's all you got to learn to me as a public speaker. All the bad public speaking, the worst public speaking doesn't come from, here I am talking about this thing I haven't cared about in a long time, but I once cared about it because I used to rant to my students. But the worst public speeches occur when we try to fill out these like pre-imagined forms of what a good speech should be. And most of the anxiety comes from feeling like we'll never measure up to that preset mold of what a good speech is. And if you can just break the mold in your head, forget all the speeches you've ever seen on TV or in movies or a great coach has given you or whatever, and just shatter that. The only thing you got to do is be real with people and to face the fear of being rejected by them. And if you do, people will literally laugh at anything you say. It doesn't even have to be funny. If they sense that you're just being yourself and you're comfortable, or you're acknowledging that you're uncomfortable, it's like if you make a mistake, say, oh my God, I'm such a bad public speaker. Just say that. That's fine. Just reacting in the moment on all that stuff, like all that improv type stuff is also useful. But
something to consider for your next book tour when you're on, you know, you're out on the road at a bookstore.
I could never do it myself. My students would be like, what about you should give a speech? And I'm like, no, I don't have to. I'm just the teacher.
Yeah, I'm just the teacher. I know how to do it. I can't do it myself, but I know how to tell you how to do it.
Exactly.
So you are now in California. I'm trying to rack my brain and remember if you were here the last time you were here. Why do I feel like you moved since the last time we spoke? Am I wrong?
Yeah, we moved many times probably. I think we used to live in Portland, Oregon. Then we moved to Georgia, where I'm from.
That's where I think you were.
On that move is when we met.
Okay, so wait, you were moving from where to where when we met?
From Oregon to Georgia.
Right.
But my wife's family is in California, so we would like come down from Oregon, stay in California. Then on our move out, I think, or maybe it was, we swung through, you know, Southern California, and I think that's when we did our interview.
Right.
But then we moved to Atlanta. 2 years later, we moved back to California.
And how do you like it?
It's great. The only thing I don't like is like, I wish I was closer to my family, but if we were in Georgia, I'd wish I was closer, and my wife would wish she was closer to her family. So I'm pretty comfortable everywhere I've ever lived. And growing up in Georgia, one thing is that it's all closed in. You know, there's not really horizon because there's trees everywhere. So you look out in your yard, or even driving down the highway, you're hemmed in by trees. And here, I still just can't get over the landscape, the mountains, and the distance. And I don't know, it just feels, it feels like a fantasy landscape to me, even though I've lived here and been here a million times. And so I think that naturally just makes me happy here, even when it's burning and whatever.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's like you take the good with the bad. It's a spectacular place to be, like from a, like the physical landscape standpoint, but there's a lot that, you know, there's a lot that comes with it too. And I don't know, I haven't yet found the motivation to leave, so I guess that says that I like it well enough to stay. But I feel like things have gotten increasingly crazy in the time that I've been here. It certainly feels like we're on that scale, like both from like a wildfires, socioeconomics, you know, human suffering, political craziness, like everything does feel like it's kind of ratcheting up. I think a lot of us are absorbing that.
Yeah, you never can tell. I certainly think it's everything feels like it's about to change for the worse in 100 million ways. And it's already not good or awful. And it's like we don't even have to name what we're talking about. It could be anything. But California feels the most complicated. Of all the places I've lived, I think it's one of the most complicated because of its massive size and massive different cultures and like just the water rights. Like I have like some family friends who are like, you know, they work in ag or water related businesses. And it's like, I can't even, every time I ask them what's going on, what are you working on? It's like, there's another Byzantine layer of complexity I just don't understand. And I feel like California is like that with everything.
Yeah, you know, but, you're right though, because it's easy to characterize it based on like its coastal capitals, but it's a big place. There's all sorts of different, you know, all sorts of different cultures and communities and politics. I mean, it's gigantic. And then, yeah, water rights. That's not going to get simplified anytime soon. Not just in California, but the whole American West. I mean, this past heat wave in June, there were a bunch of articles about that very thing because everything's drying out. So, you know, I don't know. Like, are there just going to have to be, I think there's going to ultimately have to be like just gigantic desalination plants. That's the only option, right? You have to suck it right out of the ocean and take the salt out of it in order to water everything.
I guess. I hope someone is thinking about that. I
mean, me too.
It's just like, I don't know what the solution is going to be, but I do hold out some hope that it would be, it's possible that there's unexpected solutions. That's what I like hold on to with hope, is that it's very easy to imagine calimities. I imagine catastrophes and apocalypses constantly, but what's always surprising is that either sometimes they don't happen. That's really nice. But sometimes solutions occur that are completely unexpected. So if it's desal, I hope that doesn't fuck anything up even worse. But, yeah, water would be nice. This valley where I live, you know, it would be very helpful for a lot of people to have more water, but I don't know. I was going to say one thing recently reminded me of how big California is that, with the pandemic sort of hopefully ending, I was trying to look up some, like my wife and I, we really like to go to music, but go see live music, but not big concerts, just like random bar, random band, like bluegrass or just some kind of like weird little amateur ensemble of any variety. So I'm like looking up music groups on Facebook. It's like Northern California Bluegrass Festival Circuit. And they're like posting, oh, here, we're going to play here. There's another band playing here. There's another playing here. And like, look, I was like, cool, this is it. We're going to be going to concerts this summer. Little simple stuff. And it's like, it's all like 300. It's called Northern California Bluegrass Festival. It's like everything is like at least 200 miles south of where we live. There's no, it's like, I'm not even, Northern California is like the top 3/4 of California. I thought I was like, I don't know. I feel like there's 500 miles further north, but Southerners, what I would consider a Southerner, is saying that that's Northern California. So
yeah, I haven't.
I'm really new to this place.
Me too. I've been here for 20 years and I'm like, man, I haven't even scratched the surface. I haven't been to Lake Tahoe. I've never been to Yosemite. Like, there's embarrassing gaps in my California knowledge, but it's just, I don't know. I haven't gotten around to it yet. I'll get there hopefully sooner than later, but it's, you could spend your entire life here and never see it all. You know, you can keep taking road trips, I guess, but I'm glad you're here. You know, it's nice to have another poet in state. And I really enjoyed this collection and always enjoy your work, you know, and these conversations that we've been having about it, because it fuses a lot of things that I'm interested in, like the fusion of being funny with being serious and thinking deeply about difficult things. That's my sweet spot. So I appreciate the hard work over all these years. You know, in your writing hovel, on Twitter, wherever it happens. I'm just glad that these efforts are bearing fruit and that you're putting them out there into the world.
Thank you very much, Brad. You're very gracious, and I really enjoyed this conversation and our last one. And thanks for all you do for, you know, giving writers an opportunity to talk about their work.
Right, there you go, guys. That's Mark Leidner. His new poetry collection is called Returning the Sword to the Stone, available now from Phonograph Editions. You can follow Mark Leidner on Twitter, which I recommend if you're a Twitter person. He's a good follow. His handle is at Mark Leidner, L-E-I-D-N-E-R, Mark Leidner. On Twitter. Once again, the poetry collection is called Returning the Sword to the Stone, available now from Phonograph. Go get your copy. The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this show, more than 700 episodes and counting, are all made available to you, the listener, for free. It's a listener-supported program. If you like this show, if you listen regularly, you get something from it, and you have the means, support the show. Tip your server. You can do that for as little as $1 per month over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. Drop a dollar in the hat. Drop two. Drop five. There are different levels, different tiers. And as you go up the scale, you get stuff. You can get a tote bag, a t-shirt, a coffee mug. I'll write you a postcard. I'll wish you a happy birthday. Patreon.com/otherpplpod. Support the show. You can also support this program by rating it and reviewing it over at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. It helps other listeners find the show when you rate and review the Other People podcast. So do that if you have a couple of minutes. I would appreciate it. The Other People podcast has its own app. That, too, is free. Go get the Other People with Brad Listy app, wherever you find apps. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. letters@otherppl.com. Let me know what you think. Tell me a story. The Other People podcast is now available on YouTube. It has a YouTube channel. That's a relatively recent development. Check it out. Smash the subscribe button over at YouTube. Search for the show by name, Other PPL. All right?